Well, we were talking about incorporation and raising more capital, which Cazenove very kindly took care of for us. Well, we did raise that money, and it did put us on a better footing. And I suppose, really, we just went on jobbing from there. I'm trying to remember the year of that. I can't remember which year that was. I could get that for you, but I can't remember which year it was. But anyhow, having raised the money, it gave us a new lease of life. And really, I don't think at that stage we increased our business at all. It just allowed us to go on because of this capital going out. And the next thing we did, I suppose, was of any real size, was when we came into doing the USM business. And that was, where are we now, 90, so that would have been 1980 we started. And that was our next sort of breakthrough, if you like. And it was based on the fact that we dealt in smaller companies. And as we did that, I thought, well, we can't break into the big league, because although we'd raised some capital, we weren't in that league. And so I latched on to these smaller companies and said we would deal in them all at a very early stage, which gave us the whip hand with the other jobbers. And they were very nice. They didn't want to deal in them. We had jobbers committees in those days, and it rotated between all the firms, the five main firms, who was chairman. And it wasn't, as some people think, a sort of jobbers cartel, these meetings to decide how we carve things up. There were lots of discussions about the markets and what we could do to make markets better and so on. But at those particular meetings, I made very clear to everybody that we would be dealing in these smaller companies, the USM. And we went out of our way to acquire as much knowledge and information as we could. And we very quickly established ourselves as the lead dealer in that. And the way we did it, the way we did it was to, from the word go, we decided to use the USM as a separate market. So we put it all under one umbrella, and every time a new issue came, it would go on our USM book. The other people, the other jobbers, although they said they wouldn't deal in all of those companies, they did take up the occasional company. And if it was, for instance, an insurance company, it would go into that jobber's insurance book. If it was an engineering company, and so on. So what they did was rather piecemeal. They put it on different books. What we did was to keep it under one umbrella, so that we formed the USM market, and we channeled the business our way.
Did you stand on that pitch?
Yes, I did. I ran that book because we started off with 11 stocks, and then as we grew it, suddenly there were lots and lots of issues, and then we decided to knock it into alphabetical order. And so after book one, we then went from the A to B, and then C to D's, and so on. And as it got bigger, so we incorporated and had A to G, and so on and so forth. And in the end, we had, I think, one, two, three, four, six books.
And did it work, the pitch work, well, did the market work differently to the markets that you'd been involved in previously, like garage or motors?
Well, I suppose because, I mean, actually what I did was I didn't leave it. I took it away from the main pitch and gave it really its own wall, if you like, its own market. And I suppose, so we concentrated on away from the main pitch. But really, I suppose jobbing was jobbing. I don't think it made that much difference. What we did is that we played up to what the people wanted, i.e. the public and the press. And it was a new market, and it was easy to write stories about it. It was rags to riches for entrepreneurs. And after sort of 700 issues, somebody pointed out that 700 millionaires had been created, albeit paper millionaires. But I mean, it was a high profile market, in as much that if we had new issues in that had a topical theme about it, we would go along with that topical theme. If it was a brewery, we'd have a barrel of beer on the pitch, and perhaps some of the props from a pub. If it were an engineering concern, we might have some of their pieces of machinery on the pitch. And it was good to write about things like that. And I suppose, really, at the height of, or at least one of the highlights of that market, was when Debbie Moore came onto the floor of the house to launch, what was the darn thing called? The hijinks, the exercise thing, what was it called? Debbie Moore's...
Don't worry, we can check that up, but I wasn't in the country at that time, so...
Well, anyway, Debbie Moore, she got this business of exercise places in Covent Garden. Pineapple. And she came on day one, and we used to invite the chairman and managing directors or whoever wanted to come along, and we'd take them onto the floor of the house, and we would show them what we're doing, and we would give them a copy of our first day of the dealings in our book, and we'd put it in a little presentation plaque for them. And we'd take them onto the floor of the house. Well, Debbie Moore really took the place by storm, because she turned up with some of her girls in their sort of tutu skirts and their leotards. And, of course, it was a public gallery, and she brought the place to a sort of standstill. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. And there were pictures in the Evening Standard that night of her giving me a hug and things like that. And so we had one or two things like that. And the Stock Exchange were very good about allowing us to take people onto the floor of the house. We had to get permission, but by and large, they were very good. And I think it did the Stock Exchange a lot of good. I mean, it was for the man in the street. It was smaller companies. It was, at the same time, a sort of protected environment. It wasn't like people going to the OTC markets. They did have at least the protection of the Stock Exchange. And I felt that that was the sort of thing that really brought people to identify with the Stock Exchange as investors. And we needed more of that, I think. So that was a good thing. It was a good PR, about the only decent PR exercise I think we ever did. And there were lots of occasions like that. And there were lots of issues, and it grew like Topsy. I mean, it was the most incredible innovation the Stock Exchange had adopted for 20 years, I think. And it's rather sad now that it's in its demise less than a decade later because of EC regulations. And, of course, a lot of changes are going on now. But it had a jolly good eight-year run. It grew up things like the USM magazine. It grew up things like the USM annual awards dinner. It's a little history in itself, really, albeit a short-run one, less than a decade. But a very, very significant new market for the Stock Exchange. Wonderful.
In the old house, markets were quite central. So you had all the motor pitches close to each other and so on. Had that changed in the new house? Was it different during the 1980s?
No, there were still sort of areas. I mean, for instance, looking out from our pitch, on the left-hand side was the gilt market. On the right-hand side was, I suppose, down that end were industrials and stores. And then way, way across the other market was engineering, although it was more where firms were grouped rather than industries, I felt, in the new house. In the old house, there was the Kaffa market, there was the gilt market, there was the industrial market, there was the rubber market. They were much more specified places, much more. You knew exactly in that area who was who and what was what. In the new house, it was much more of a mixture. It was where Derlacher was, it was where Aykroyd was, it was where Bisgood was. So it had changed from markets to firms, I think, really. within those firms, we tried to separate as much as we could. But, for instance, in our small firm, being number five in the main jobbers, the whole of Bisgood was on one pitch. So whether you were dealing in USM or fixed interest or... or industrials, they were all on one hexagon, whereas Wed had many hexagons. And we tried to keep markets as near as we could. For instance, our fixed interest, although it was in the same area, it backed onto the gilt market. But it had changed from very definitive markets to firms, I think. That was the change there.
It's also been said that in the old house, there was an atmosphere, and that an old jobber could go into the house and just buy... his feel of things, he could, the feel of the market, he could get a sense of the way things were running. Was that still the case?
Yes, although I think one had to walk round more to identify those areas. But certainly the original house, you could walk through and you would just get the feel, that's quite right, and you'd get the buzz and the atmosphere. And if you walked in the old house, you'd sort of walk through those markets to get to your own pitch, at least I did. you'd go through the Kaffa market and you'd hear very quickly what was going on there. Then you'd go through the gilt market, you'd hear that. And you've got a whole picture built up, whereas in the new house, I found that I had to walk round, having got to my pitch, I would have to walk round to see what they were doing elsewhere. Mm. And of course, with this new system we have now, there is no atmosphere, there's no feel, but what you've got with the screen-driven prices is immediately you know whether the market is up or down because it's blue or red throughout the list. Mm. Anyway, that's another discussion, but the difference is incredible.
There was one comment that came up in the interview that we did last week, which I just want to ask for a follow-up on. You said that the market always knew more about security than you did as a jobber. I mean, they knew more about how it was, how the company was doing and so on. Unless you are an insider, unless you, the jobber, are an insider. Were there cases of that happening, either in the old days or...
Well, the market, I mean, I'm a great believer in the market tells you something all the time. And when I said that, what it meant was that the daily interpretation of prices was that jobbers were reflecting supply and demand. Mm-hmm. That supply and demand would go out of the window if suddenly a specific broker came in that we would regard as hot. And you would find all of a sudden that it had changed from sort of two-way business to very much one direction. And the nature of the animal being that one didn't want to get left behind, if this chap that was nearly always right 8 times out of 10, you'd all go with him. And so the market looked as though it had changed direction, and it must have been very worrying for the man outside because all of a sudden something had changed. And a lot of that must have been connected with insider trading. Mm. It just didn't happen that way. I mean, markets can build up over a period because they sense that the economy is changing or they sense that the product has changed or something like that, but that is a general build up. These things happened almost instantaneously. Mr. X would come in the door and you think, oh, what's he up to? And then you'd sort of try and hedge your bets by perhaps widening the price or being, as he was usually a buyer, you'd probably slant it that you would be a buyer rather than a seller, and then depending what he did sort of triggered off the whole reaction in that market, or at least in that stock. Mm. There was a lot of insider trading. Yes, I mean, you can see now that some of those firms that prospered are going or gone, excuse me, and that's because without that sort of insider trading the ordinary investment business doesn't go their way. No, it was rife. That was definitely right. But the point I think I was making was that jobbers, I mean, people would give you the wink, if you like. They'd say, mind your eye. They wouldn't say anything more specific than that. And you would gauge which way you want to be because of the animal that was coming to deal with you. But if you, as a jobber, had believed everything you heard, you would have been a bull of everything. I mean, 8 times out of 10, these stories fizzled out. The chap who started them didn't care because he made a lot of commission. But a lot of them were sort of made up, I mean, rumours. And a jobber had to be careful that he wasn't so gullible that he believed everything. And that's why jobbers could not be accused of insider trading. After all, if you could actually rig a jobber quite easily by fear and scaring him into position. So I think we were a bit wiser than that. I don't think we were actually that gullible.
Was the stock exchange a place where rumours did fly around?
Oh, yes. I mean, the easiest place in the world. I mean, there were people in there. If you wanted to get a room, you'd go and tell a chap in absolute confidence and you knew it'd be around in 5 minutes. I mean, it's human nature, isn't it? They can't wait to tell somebody else. Mm. And, of course, that sort of community spreads like wildfire. Mm. And I mean, one or two of the boys start to get in and have a punt. A little bit of blue appears on the screen and that sort of starts the fire. And they all pile in, and then suddenly somebody denies it, and of course they all pile out, and that's what makes a market, really. You know, it is these ideas and rumours and so on. And they happen now. You see every day a stock will take off for one reason or another, and there's a lot of inquiry going on, but they're not just informed guesses. Even now, there must be people in the know. Stocks don't just take off for no apparent reason.
Looking at the whole period of your career in the stock exchange, did you have cases of jobbers becoming too close to brokers?
I think yes. I think some jobbers were very close, perhaps because of their size and the power they exerted. I mean, there were many takeover situations where you needed the help of a major jobber to be able to say that you'd acquired the right amount of stock to force that thing through. You would need perhaps a jobber to start you off in an enormous order, and that was what the risk-reward ratio was all about. Yes, some of the major firms were very close to major jobbers, and there were only 15 or so jobbers at the end, and there were only 5 major jobbers, so most of them were fairly close. I would think that we, dealing in smaller companies, were not so close as... I mean, there were occasions when we were, if you like, in the parlour with somebody about a particular takeover, but we weren't that powerful, I'm afraid. In hindsight, I suppose that wasn't a bad thing. But yes, some people were very close, very close indeed. Mm. Whereas perhaps we would only know members of the stock exchange and people outside the huge companies, the Wed de Lackers of those years. I mean, they were known in the corridors of power. They were huge, influential firms that had very big people running them, that knew people in the city, that knew... They were always in the banking parlours. They knew everybody. They were all powerful. Mm. I don't think that my partners were, with the exception of perhaps Harry Bishop, who was the original senior partner when I got there, most of the others were fairly lightweight in the city. Mm. And they didn't go out and mix with people. They didn't know the bankers as they should have done, in my opinion. But then it was a much, much smaller firm. Mm. But the big boys were very powerful.
Getting on to the 1980s, we're told that one of the things that was putting pressure on single capacity was the internationalisation of the stock market and the number of particularly American houses setting up in London and themselves bypassing the stock exchange completely, and brokers wanting to get into that business, and the fear of jobbers that they were not seeing as much of the business as they might otherwise. Was that something that you were conscious of?
Well, I think jobbers were always feared that they're missing something. It's the nature of the animal again. But I think we're more likely to miss business since deregulation than we were before deregulation. And that was because, by and large, most things did come through the exchange because of the Rule 90, which obliged people to show that to the market. I suppose huge bargains were done for minuscule turns, which is what upset a lot of the market makers, jobbers. But equally, the brokers became all powerful because there were huge business huge bargains going on. The Americans, well, it wasn't so much that they were... interfere with international relations, but they were powerhouses and huge capital bases that could force things through for no sensible reason. And I think a lot of things did go on outside of the market that annoyed us, but I don't think we could identify particularly what they were. And as I say, I think it's fear of not missing the business that in lots of cases probably wasn't there, you know. I mean, it was a lot of talk. And perhaps I wouldn't be the right person to ask that because we weren't so influential. But you might get an answer from Aykroyd or from Wed de Lacker on that. But we wouldn't have been in those areas, really.
Well, now let's to start concluding, talk about perhaps jobbing in general terms. What would you say were the strengths of the jobbing system?
Well, the capacities, the separation of capacities has always struck me as the most sensible thing. In a way, that was the policeman of the exchange. The fact that jobbers only dealt with members and that the brokers were agency brokers, they only dealt with, well, they dealt with everybody. But that separation, I think, afforded us a lot of protection. We couldn't be accused of lots of things that we're accused of now. And it just seemed to me that was the way that business should be conducted. And I think you will see now, with the demise of quite a few market making outfits, that what people have become now because of the pushing together of the capacities is that those people that have gone out, they became, in a sense, inventory jobbers. And so when they packed up their business, you found that when they were liquidating their books, they were perhaps a bull of 1% of this, a half a million of that, 200,000 of this, they were short of 300,000 of that. And what they weren't reflecting, or they are, what they're not reflecting, is ordinary supply and demand. What they're reflecting is that because of this putting together of the capacities, the salesmen are forcing market-making arms of integrated houses to take on positions that they ordinarily wouldn't have done had they been jobbers. Mm. We don't come up against that. We reflect supply and demand. They reflect the pressures put on them by the other parts of their firms. Mm. And that does seem to me a great fear, that that markets can dictate not just basically supply and demand, and equally that you don't get best execution in that environment.
Mm.
And perhaps we're going full circle, perhaps we're turning the clock back, I don't know. Mm. It seems unsatisfactory to me, I must say.
Did the jobbing system have any weaknesses?
Well, of course, in the very early days, I mean, I always remember somebody saying when there was no capital gains tax that there was a jobber there that, as he dealt, he would say, right, there's one for me, one for the book, one for me, one for the book. And I think that a lot of those people in the very early days, they milked the books. I mean, there was no doubt in my mind they milked the books. And of course, the other thing was that there were enough unscrupulous people in there who tried, and it happened to me on many occasions, and perhaps moral attitudes were different in those days, but there were many people who tried to get me to milk my book. Mm. Because really, I mean, it was all about trust. Mm. And it was dictum et impectum, and you did have that jobbing book, you recorded bargains in that jobbing book, mm. but it was the easiest thing in the world to put yes. false bargains.
Without mentioning names, could you give an example?
Well, I mean, there was a young broker friend of mine when I got authorised very early on. When I was authorised, he said that he'd just got a marvellous client in his firm, a young chap with an institution. And he said, it's extraordinary. He said, but this chap sees all the takeovers. And he said, you know, I think, you know, if there's something on your book that we could trade in, he would know very early on, and we could. And I said, well, it does seem to me that's wrong. I mean, I'm not holier than thou, but nevertheless, it did seem to me that it was very, very wrong. And we talked about it, and I think he was as scared of it as I was. And in the end, he refused to deal with the chap. And so, sort of, we lived happily ever after. But I do remember that very well. I mean, he was a good pal of mine. And I said, you know, but this is very dangerous because you could do this and do that. And in the end, he actually didn't deal with this man. And I suppose, in turn, you see, that fellow was much more experienced, and he was trying to get the young fellow to do his dirty work. And that young fellow had a friend in me who had a book. And all I can say is that, you know, thank God I didn't go over that thin dividing line, because it was one of the easiest things in the world. And of course, it happened with other half commission men who said, you know, if you'd like to sort of help us out in some of our bargains, we would make it up to you at the end of the period. I mean, there was a lot of that went on, and I dare say a lot of people fell for it. And it does make me sound a bit sort of too nice for words, but I didn't fall for it, and I think it's purely simply because I wouldn't have slept nights, frankly. I mean, I'm a rotten liar at the best of times, and you've only got to ask my wife. I think she can see it on my face if I lie, but and that's why I always pay coming through the customs. I'm just no good at fibbing, I'm afraid, but a lot of it went on,
mm.
a great deal of it went on, yes. Mm. And I'm sure that people did make a very nice sideline, and actually something that would have made that work was a lot of the people were very poorly paid, you know, mm. clerks with stock exchange firms. Mm. But they were badly paid. There was a promise at the end of the road in some of them, but I mean, those people didn't even get pensions, you know. I mean, I know contemporaries of mine that are now out, if you like, but they're not living on anything other than perhaps the goodwill of the clerks' provident fund and perhaps the old age pension. Well, not the old age pension, but certainly where people have had to go out of the business because they've lost their jobs at an early age, perhaps 50, they've got very little in the bank. Mm. You they weren't good savers, and as I said, they didn't really have pensions. It was pretty awful. Although, you know, you had very good times, and I suppose, like everybody, when you're young, you don't really worry about when you're getting old. But and hopefully nowadays, most firms do take care of that without people having to worry. But in those days, they didn't get pensions. Mm. And it was pretty awful, I thought.
If Stock Exchange being a place where there was a lot of turnover of stocks and transactions were being done for large sums of money, being in that environment, even if the money wasn't for you, do you think that ever encouraged greed?
Well, I think it did, but there's a difference between seeing pieces of paper change hands and if you like, pound notes changing hands. And it's just as well, really, because it's rather funny. I, as a jobber, say to my boys, now, as far as I'm concerned, they're all apples and pears, and you just remember how much money's involved. But I think when I was a jobber, it was different. You were dealing in stocks and shares and pieces of paper, and it really wasn't your responsibility to think of the money involved somehow. Although people wouldn't let, I mean, one was always under the rule of somebody else, and you weren't allowed to get outrageous positions. But it's rather funny that the attitude was different then. And I suppose if somebody came and had a bet with you on a horse and they gave you £10, it really was a lot of money, but you were dealing in hundreds of thousands of pounds and not thinking twice about it. I mean, that's a bit simplistic, and obviously there were people there who were unscrupulous, and as I suppose as a broker you actually saw money, whereas a jobber you tended not. I mean, you didn't pay anybody. I mean, you never saw anything. Everything was paid by check. Whereas a broker, if you were a half-con man, some of your clients might ask for £500 in cash. And it's funny how, you know, just sort of seeing money, it might make you more aware of what it was personally. It's just funny, though, isn't it? Mm. But it's fact, I think.
Did you feel that you were at the risky end of the industry as a jobber?
Well, of course, I crossed over the bridge because I started originally as a broker, and as I think I said earlier, it was very difficult to break in to make any real money because there were no contacts. And so, one felt you could, if through your own ability, you might get somewhere, and that suited me very nicely. I suppose we always felt, as one got older, that perhaps your firm's days were numbered because if your senior partners had left, as they did eventually, when we managed to raise capital, but without sort of rich people coming through in the old partnership days, you could have seen that if a few of those guys had died and the rest wanted to pack up, that you know, your firm would go out. I suppose one always hoped that you were able enough to go and get a job with another broker, with another jobber. But then, of course, you became a small cog in a very big wheel. And what was so lovely about BizGood was that you had a chance of really going up the ladder. I suppose, yes, one did fear it a bit, although there were long, long runs of bull markets. And honestly, it all disappears in a bull market. You know, nobody's thinking of packing up. It's only when things get really tough and rough. And I suppose really one must be grateful that people stuck together in 74, because the easiest thing to have done then was to split companies in half and got rid of the staff. But people were pretty good, I thought. I mean, I thought they stood by the responsibilities remarkably well in those dull days. Had that happened a bit earlier in my career, I think I would have had a great fear, but they were very good. They were very good. I was amazed how good people were, actually. It was more natural waste than sacking people.
My final question, what do you think it took to be a successful jobber?
Well, hopefully I'm a successful jobber, maybe I'm not, but I think so far as I was concerned was you've got to have a good friendly approach to people. After all, if they don't speak to you, you'll never do their business. There are two ways of looking at it, I think. You can be affable and get people to deal with you because they like you, and then you have to be pretty sharp at what you do. Equally, you can be the nastiest so-and-so in town in a different market, which is sort of jobbing, like in the say the options market, where you're as good as your price and people have to deal with you. But for myself as a jobber, I think I think if having the strength of a sort of family firm around you gave you the confidence that what you were doing was worthwhile, and our firm in particular, it was quite rewarding at the end of the day. The actual mechanics of why you're successful, I don't know. I mean, I lived, breathed, and slept Stock Exchange. I mean, having the Financial Times was like reading your Bible, really. You couldn't be without it. I really was completely involved in it. I mean, it was like being married to a job, really, you know. It was, and I always said to my wife, strangely enough, I said, you know, the three most important things in my life, it's my very early days, was that my job, my wife, and whatever else came along. And it was many years later, and she knows this perfectly well, but I said to her at one stage where I think that I'd got my partnership and I was reasonably established, I said, darling, everything's changed. Most important things in my life now are you, my children, and the job. But at the beginning of my career, it was very much my job was more important than anything else. I really mean that. I felt that very strongly. But I think it's all to do with the people that you're surrounded by. I think it's to do with your own ability. You've got to be fair and reasonably minded. A little bit sharp, a little bit streetwise, I think.